Good afternoon. Welcome, everybody. I'm Ken Sullivan, and on behalf of the West Virginia Humanities Council, welcome to the historic 1836 McFarland Hubbard House. Turns 180 years old this year, and I do hope you'll look the place over before you leave. Sign our visitors register out front, too, please. We'd love to be able to stay in touch with you. There's a visitors register on the table in the foyer, and do please put your name and address there. This is our second little lecture of 2016, and boy, do we have a timely topic for you today. We have presented this series annually since 2001. The remaining lectures this year include on May 15, Shaker Village of Pleasant Hill, Kentucky by Jill Modlewski. June 12, West Virginia Folklore and Folklorists by Professor Judy Myers. We want to remind you that you're invited to stay for refreshments and a glass of wine after the lecture. I hope you'll do that. The hors d'oeuvres are once again generously provided by our good friend Jennifer Soule. We thank her for that. Today's speaker has written his own introduction in the headlines. I don't think I've seen a more dramatic cover than that. Until I got today's paper, and it's right in there. I'm not guilty of a crime. So we've got, having said that, he requires no introduction. Of course, I will go ahead and introduce him. He is a reporter for the Charleston Gazette Mail, a native of Mineral County, and a graduate of West Virginia University. Since starting at the Gazette in 1991, he has received numerous regional and national reporting awards for his coverage of mining, timbering, and other industrial and environmental subjects. He is a three-time winner of the Scripps Howard Foundation's Edward J. Meeman Award for Environmental Reporting. He is a recipient of the prestigious Livingston Award for Young Journalists. In 2006, he spent 6 months researching coal mining issues as an Alicia Patterson Fellow. The resulting series was recognized with a medal from the group Investigative Reporters and Editors. In February 2009, he began the Coal Tattoo blog, which incidentally is named for a song title by Billy Ed Wheeler, who also has spoken in this series. The blog has been described as a must-read for reporters wanting to understand the coal industry in the United States. He'd been interviewed by the Columbia Journalism Review, which described his reporting as fierce. And his work has been cited by the New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, PBS, and other news outlets. He's covered numerous coal mining disasters, including the Upper Big Branch mine disaster that led to the prosecution of Massey Energy CEO Don Blankenship. He lives in Charleston with his wife Elizabeth and their son Thomas, both of whom are with us today. Thank you all for coming. And also lives with Cat Henry, who it says here unfortunately was unable to make it today. His mother Laura is with us as well, I understand. And welcome to all of you all. Won't you please welcome Ken Ward, Jr., who will speak of his experience reporting the West Virginia trial of the century.
Thank you, Ken. Thanks, everyone, for coming. It's very humbling for me to give this particular lecture. Some of the people who have done this before, John Alexander Williams, Ron Lewis, really giants, people who have had huge influences on my life and the way I try to do my job. If you can tell, I'm a little nervous. I'll try to get through this. And feel free to go have some wine and maybe things will go down a little bit. last week, a remarkable thing happened at the Robert C. Byrd United States Courthouse, just a few blocks from here across town. The former CEO, the chief executive officer, and chairman of the board of the biggest coal producer in Appalachia, was sentenced to federal prison because he conspired to violate the federal safety rules that are intended to keep his miners from getting hurt, killed, or made sick. Don Blankenship was once a powerful man, maybe the most powerful in West Virginia. The media sought out his opinion on everything, every issue of the day. He played kingmaker, pumping money, sometimes secretly, into political campaigns. He was and remains immensely wealthy. To give him his due, he came from a very humble beginning. He's given back to the community where he grew up, the son of a single mother, he barely knew his father. He worked his way up, first earning a degree from Marshall, working his way through college, becoming a CPA. Then he climbed from being a mere office manager at a small unit of Massey Energy to being the CEO of a major company traded on the New York Stock Exchange. U.S. District Judge Irene Berger said last week, when she ordered Blankenship to serve a year in jail and pay a $250,000 fine, that he could have been a success story, someone for West Virginians to hold up, someone for kids in Southern West Virginia to admire. Proof that you can come from Mingo or Logan or McDowell County and still be whatever you want to be. But Judge Berger told Blankenship when she sentenced him, instead of being able to tout you as one of West Virginia's success stories, we're here as a result of your part in a dangerous conspiracy. That dangerous conspiracy, as the judge called it, aimed to produce coal, as much coal as possible, no matter the cost. The conspiracy happened at an underground coal mine in Raleigh County called Upper Big Branch. Nobody had heard of it until April 5th, 2010. Now you all know, the whole world knows what happened there. Massive underground explosion, 29 men died. Judge Berger said that Blankenship had emphasized the production of coal at UBB while failing to ensure that safety and compliance were given appropriate attention and financial support. It turns out, today's headline aside, that according to the evidence in this case, at least according to the way a jury of 12 West Virginians saw it, and apparently the way Judge Berger read that evidence, that the labor unions, the miners who worked for him, the trial lawyers who sued him, the newspaper reporters like Paul Niden, who wrote about him for years before any of us knew who he was, it turns out they were all right about Blankenship all along. At least that's what the jury said. The scene last week in federal court, as I said, was historic. Others have said that too. Never before has a coal CEO, or any CEO really, of any company, not of a company this big, been charged, convicted, and sentenced to jail for a conspiracy not to steal from stockholders, but to violate the laws that we've learned over decades and decades are needed to keep coal miners from being blown up, crushed, dismembered, or left crippled with deadly lung disease. The sentencing hearing lasted barely 2 hours. It started at 10. We were out of there much before lunch. But it was the end of a much larger story about Don Blankenship and Massey, about what's happened in our state's southern coal fields in the wake of his company's efforts to get rid of the union and to mine coal through whatever means it could, whether by systematically violating mine safety laws or by literally blowing the tops off of mountains and dumping what was left of them into the streams. Books have been written about all of this. More books will be written. I can't fit it all in here today, but I want to try to tell you a little bit about the trial that I had a great honor of covering for the state's largest newspaper. And so before I forget, I want to thank my editors, one of whom, Greg Moore, is here today, and the owners of the newspaper for giving me the freedom they gave me to cover this. I wish that Joel Ebert, who covered the trial with me, was here. I learned a lot from him. He'd come over in the combination of the two newspapers and was thrown in with me covering this trial. As Ken said, my wife Elizabeth's here and my son Thomas. I'm not sure why they want to hear me talk for 45 more minutes about this. But Thomas wanted me to make sure to point out that, and I can, if you come up to me later, I'll show you the picture, that Don Blankenship's house, which sits on a hilltop overlooking Mingo County, looks exactly like Princess Peach's castle in Mario 64. And my mom, Laura Ward, is here today, and I thank her for coming, for everything else. It was about 8:30 a.m. on October 1st last year, out in front of the Byrd Courthouse there on Virginia Street. You probably pass it many times. And it wasn't quite the scene you would have expected. It wasn't a big limo. It wasn't a parade of black SUVs. It was a kind of worn-looking blue minivan pulled up, and Don Blankenship got out. He walked up the stairs. There were reporters all over the place, TV cameras, and he smiled and just kind of said yes when we asked him if he still maintained he was innocent. About 10 months before that, a federal grand jury had handed up an indictment that named Blankenship as the defendant. It's charged him with conspiring to violate federal mine safety standards and conspiring to defraud U.S. Mine Safety and Health Administration inspectors. Both of these conspiracies occurred at the Upper Big Branch mine over a more than two-year period prior to the day of the deadly explosion. The indictment also alleged that Blankenship had lied to shareholders and committed stock fraud when, as Massey's stock and his own personal wealth were plummeting following the media reports about the disaster, he told investors that the company did not condone safety violations and strove to always comply with the law. Now let's talk just for a minute about conspiracy. It's not what you think it is. It's not Don Corleone or Avon Barksdale in a back room plotting to control the rackets in New York or the drug trade in Baltimore. Well, it is that, but it doesn't have to be. Conspiracy is an incredibly powerful tool in a prosecutor's toolbox. Under federal law, conspiracy is simply an agreement between two or more people to join together to accomplish some unlawful purpose. A conspiracy is basically kind of a partnership in crime, in which each member becomes the agent of other members, according to one of the model jury instructions that's used in these cases. A conspiracy seeks to accomplish other crimes, which are called the objects of the conspiracy. In Blankenship's case, the most important of those, at least the one he was found guilty of and the one that put people's lives at risk, was the conspiracy to routinely violate federal mine safety and health standards. The powerful thing about conspiracy cases, what makes them so valuable for prosecutors, is that to prove a conspiracy, the government doesn't have to generally show that there was a specific formal spoken agreement by those involved in the conspiracy. And what's really incredible is that the government doesn't even have to prove that the conspiracy worked. In theory, you could conspire to sell drugs and still be convicted of the conspiracy, even if you never actually sold any drugs. More to the point in this case, Blankenship wasn't charged with violating a mine safety standard. No one alleged that he disabled a methane monitor or turned off a mine ventilation fan. They didn't even allege that he ordered anyone to do those things. The allegation, his offensive conviction, the lawyers call it, was that he conspired to do those kinds of things. A few days later, on October 8th, Bobby Polly took the stand. She hardly looked the part of a hard-nosed coal miner. She was tall, with long, curly, blonde hair. She was the only woman working underground at Upper Big Branch. She described for jurors that the terrible conditions that she and other Upper Big Branch miners suffered through that day. Little or no fresh air, roof falls, high water. Bobby Polly was the first in a parade of miners who took the stand in this trial. This has never happened before. It probably won't happen again anytime soon. The miners from Upper Big Branch were in federal court testifying against their boss, the CEO of the company where they worked, against Don Blankenship. There was Michael Smith. He told jurors that proper ventilation was a recurring problem. There were a lot of issues with low air. So often you couldn't count, he said. There was Scott Halstead, who showed the jury his fire boss book, which on page after page after page, there were listed hazards that he routinely found in the mine that Massey never corrected. There was Gary Young, whose job it was to spread crushed limestone, called rock dust, around the mine to prevent explosions. The problem was the dusting machine was broken all the time. Or Young couldn't get a mine locomotive to pull it underground so he could do his job. I'm set up to fail here, Young told the jury, reading from a notebook that he kept during his time at UBB. Then there was Stanley Stewart. Everyone knows me, calls me Goose, he said when he took the stand. Goose told the jury about those same kind of working conditions. But then it came time to cross-examine him. Blair Brown, one of Blankenship's defense lawyers, decided to try to go after Goose. He pointed out that Goose had a relative who worked for the United Mine Workers, and that he suggested that the UMWA had set up Goose to go speak at a congressional hearing. And he said, he asked him, "You were seen during the lunch break talking to a reporter from 60 Minutes. Was that true? Were you talking to 60 Minutes?" Well, that opened the door just enough. And when U.S. Attorney Booth Goodwin, the guy who brought this case, got up to do redirect on Goose Stewart, he asked him, "Well, why did you start speaking out?" Goose said, "Well, after what happened, I felt like the truth needed to be told about why that mine blew up. And so I wanted it known. And they had a code of silence there. Hardly anybody would speak up. They were scared. They were still scared to speak up. And I said, I'm going to speak up. I'm going to tell the truth." Goose had been there that day. He barely got out of the mine alive himself. The men who died there were his friends, like family. By the time he finished his answer, Stewart was fighting back tears. So were the families and the miners who died at UBB. They were sitting right in the front row of the courtroom. Jurors were looking right at them. The jury knew who they were. "No further questions," Goodwin told the judge. So much for this trial not being about the mine explosion. When Goose stepped down, the next witness was a guy named James McElroy. He was an MSHA inspector. He had examined the Upper Big Branch longwall mining machine after the explosion, and he told the jury about that examination. Steve Ruby, the assistant U.S. attorney, brought out a clear plastic box containing government's exhibits 219 and 220. These were shearer bits, cutting bits from the longwall machine. Ruby passed them around the jury. McElroy said, "One of them appears to be a new bit. The other one has considerable wear." He explained to the jurors that when these bits are worn out, they can spark. They can get hot. They can cause an explosion. He also showed the jury nozzles from water sprays that are supposed to control those sparks so that a little spark on the longwall doesn't turn into a big explosion. So much again for this trial not being about the mine explosion. Later, when they went into a conference room off of the courtroom to deliberate, the jurors had those shearer bits in the water nozzles, the ones that were on the machine where the explosion occurred, in the jury room with them. I always thought that was a little spooky. Another one of the major witnesses in the trial was a guy named Chris Blanchard. Blanchard's a really smart guy, a really rich guy. He's an engineer from Virginia Tech. When he was on the stand being asked financial questions, he didn't need the calculator to add up all of these numbers. He could do it in his head. He was one of Don Blankenship's top lieutenants. The prosecutors had told Blanchard, "We want you to testify against Blankenship." He said no. They said, "We won't indict you." "There were really two bad choices," Blanchard told the jury. Blanchard gave the government most of what they had hoped to get out of him. He told them there was an understanding that a certain number of safety violations would be written that could have been prevented. He testified later, "I believe there was an understanding that it was cheaper to, or it was less money to, pay the fines for the violations than the cost of preventing them." Then Bill Taylor, Blankenship's lead defense lawyer, took over. He cross-examined Blanchard for more than a week. Lawyers around the courthouse were joking it was the longest cross-examination in West Virginia history. Day after day, I would tell my editors, the headline is, "Blanchard's still on the stand." Well, Taylor got Blanchard to say a lot of things that he liked too. He got Blanchard to say that he didn't conspire with Blankenship. He didn't commit any crimes. "I didn't break any laws," he testified. He told the jury at length about all of Don Blankenship's efforts to improve safety. Still, the most interesting thing about Blanchard was that he agreed with Bill Taylor when the defense lawyer said that safety violations are inevitable, and that trying to get to zero violations would shut down the coal industry altogether. Taylor later cited those words in his closing argument when he tried to convince the jury that violations are as much a part of coal mining as a scoop. Tipping off inspectors? Taylor said that's just the way things are done in the coal mines. It was like we flashed back to Tony Boyle, the corrupt UMWA president who said after Farmington, 78 miners were killed in 1968. As long as we mine coal, there will be this inherent danger. It was like we went back to 1972 when Pittston Coal told us the Buffalo Creek disaster was an act of God. 5 days later, with everyone joking about Taylor and how long he had taken, Steve Ruby got up again and tried to make a joke out of all of this. "We have a lot to talk about," he told Blanchard. Tried to create contradictions in things that Blanchard had said to the grand jury, things that Blanchard had testified on direct. But in the end, Blanchard had hurt the prosecution. And even this didn't really turn around his testimony. Ruby tried to get Blanchard to help the jurors understand that Massey had plenty of money. They had lots of money. They easily could have complied with all these safety regulations. For example, he had Blanchard read aloud from a U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission filing that showed Massey reported more than $50 million in profits in 2008. "Was that enough?" Ruby asked him. "Enough what, sir?" Blanchard responded, seeming not to understand the question. "Enough profit," Ruby said. "It was profit, sir. I can't answer that question." Blanchard didn't understand. By the end, though, the government was distancing itself from Chris Blanchard, its star witness. He was one of Blankenship's yes men, they said in their closing argument, who did what he was told. Another one of the major witnesses for the government was Bill Ross. If you flash back to early October when the jury selection was still going on, Judge Berger was days away from finishing this process, continuing her closed-door jury selection process. I'll talk more about that in a little bit. Behind the scenes, the lawyers were arguing over what Bill Ross was going to get to say. The defense was desperate to keep Steve Ruby and Bill Ross from talking about what Massey's violations were like and what Bill Ross thought about them. Bill Ross had worked his way up in the coal industry like Don Blankenship. He started out shoveling belts, ended up as the top ventilation expert for MSHA's district office in southern West Virginia. When he retired, he was lured to Massey with promises he could help reform a company that had come to believe had a lot of problems. Ross quickly found out things weren't going to work out that way. There was a lot of resistance, and he didn't see the improvements he thought were needed. Eventually, Ross put his fears down on paper. Massey had a worse track record than many other companies, Ross wrote. The inspectors continued to find repeat violations. Massey never improves. The attitude of many Massey operations is, if you can get the footage, we can pay the fine. The really incredible thing is that what Ross had to say and memos that went directly to Blankenship would have never made it to court at all if Blankenship himself hadn't sued Alpha Natural Resources in a different court in Delaware to try to make Alpha keep paying his legal expenses for this trial. The prosecutors have never seen or heard of these memos before. By the end, they viewed them about as close as they could get to a smoking gun. As with so many other things about West Virginia's coal industry, the Obama administration hung over this trial. Defense lawyers clearly thought tainting the prosecution with Obama and his war on coal would be a winning strategy. The best example of this came during the cross-examination of a little-noticed witness, the government expert on securities issues, Frank Torquio. Torquio was there to explain the press release that went out about not condoning safety violations and why that mattered. But defense lawyer Eric Dolinsky had other ideas. Early in his cross-examination, he said, "Do you know who Barack Obama is?" Dolinsky could get into all of this because part of the timeline for these memos included a White House Rose Garden speech that that Obama had made. During the course of that cross-examination, Dolinsky said said Obama's name 36 times. Prosecutors will try to keep this kind of stuff out of the trial, but Judge Berger let it in. FBI agent Jim Lafferty, the government's last witness, tried to respond to it. He told the jury, "I never received a phone call from President Obama directing me to do anything." But let's not kid ourselves. Politics and elections, like Karl Rove says, matter. President Obama hasn't been to West Virginia very often. One of those rare visits was to eulogize the UVB miners. The president said, "We cannot bring back the 29 men we lost. They are with the Lord now. Our task here on earth is to save the lives, is to save lives from being lost in another such tragedy. To do what we must to individually and collectively to assure safe conditions underground." Was this case political? Well, every case is political, to the extent that the president appoints the attorney general and a whole lot of other people with the Department of Justice. The president appoints U.S. attorneys all around the country. And these people, political appointees, they set priorities and use their discretion to decide how to use the government's resources and what sort of cases and what sorts of crimes are deserving of prosecution. The president appoints the guy who runs the U.S. Labor Department and the person who runs the Federal Mine Safety and Health Administration. The current administration has made it a priority to try to end black lung disease and to stop law firms and company doctors from cheating miners out of their black lung benefits, just to name two examples. Increasingly, though, groups that say they are friends of the coal miners are calling efforts like these part of the president's war on coal. November 16th was about a week before Thanksgiving, and all of us at the courthouse were preparing for the start of a long defense. Blankenship's lawyers had 140 witnesses on their witness list, 140. They had whittled that down to maybe 24. They were arguing last-minute motions about what kind of evidence could get in. Blankenship's first witness, his friend, former Massey board member Stan Subaleski, was in a holding room across from the courthouse waiting to testify. Then defense lawyer Bill Taylor dropped a bombshell. He stood up. "Ladies and gentlemen, the defense rests." Blankenship wasn't going to put on a case. No defense witnesses, no experts. Blankenship wasn't going to take the stand. There wasn't going to be week-long cross-examination by the prosecutors of Blankenship. The judge sent the jurors home, told them to come back the next day for closing arguments. Of course, the jurors had already heard from Blankenship. Prosecutors had played for them a series of phone calls in which Blankenship talked openly about how to make the most of Massey's stock options, complained that the board was trying to limit his pay to $12 million a year, and that he couldn't buy groceries with stock options. Blankenship worried about the Ross memo, too. It would be bad if it became public in a lawsuit. It was even worse than the Charleston Gazette article. Booth Goodman played those calls again during his closing argument. They wanted the jury to hear Blankenship's voice again. Bill Taylor tried to emphasize that there was no proof Blankenship was guilty. Certainly there was reasonable doubt. The last word in the trial went to Steve Rudy, the prosecutor who spent 5 years of his life working on this case. Most of the people I've talked to said this was really the key moment in the trial. I want to read a little bit of what Steve Rudy said. He wanted the jurors to understand what it was like to be a miner at UVB. "Picture going underground every day, miles away from daylight in complete darkness. Picture, if you can, being miles away from fresh air, not being able to get enough of it, being told by your bosses to keep on mining without so much as a breeze. And methane gas you know can become explosive if there is not enough air to blow it away from you. Picture mining day in and day out, 8 or 10 hours a day, while you're there literally choking on the coal dust and the air around you. Picture having your boss tell you to go reroute the air in the mine because safety inspectors are coming, and you've got to trick them into thinking there's enough fresh air in the part of the mine where your friends are working. And then picture being told to go take your friend's fresh air away as soon as the inspector leaves. So they go back to sweating and choking and being afraid that the methane gas is going to come back again. Picture telling your boss you were afraid something bad, something serious, was going to happen at UBB. Telling anybody who would listen and being ignored. We all know what happened after that. Well, most of it. We don't know for sure what happened in that jury room. Only a few of the jurors ever agreed to talk. They deliberated for 50 hours over 10 days. Several times they came back to Judge Berger and said, "Judge, we can't reach a decision. What should we do?" The judge sent them back to work. 50 hours over 10 days. For those of us in the press, the jury deliberations were kind of what a lot of journalism often involves, waiting. In this case, waiting, sitting on hard benches in the courthouse hallway. We got to sit there in the courtroom for a while. And there we could see right away if the jury had a note, because they handed it through a side door to one of the court security, and then we knew something was going on. They kicked us out of the courtroom after that. There's a lot of waiting in journalism, waiting for phone calls to be returned, waiting for FOIA responses, waiting for editors to read your stories. There's a lot of hurry up and wait, and the jury deliberations were certainly like that. I was asked not to retry the Blankenship case here, and I hope I haven't done that. I was asked also to talk a little bit about what it was like reporting on this case, and so I want to try to talk just for a few more minutes about that, without doing too much navel gazing, the kind of stuff that people in my line of work see overly prone to do. The first thing that really happened once this case was filed was that the day after the indictment, on her own, without anyone asking for it, sua sponte, the lawyers call it, Judge Berger entered a gag order, a really broad one. None of the documents filed in the case could be seen by the public. Even the indictment, which was public the day before, was taken out off of the court computer system. No one could talk to the press, not the lawyers, the defense lawyers, no family members, victims of this case, none of the family members could talk to the press. Remarkably broad gag order. Rob Byers, one of my editors, later said that I walked across the newsroom purposefully that day and said, "Rob, we just have to challenge this." And we did. This was the biggest criminal case in West Virginia in many years, maybe ever, I don't know. We've tried congressmen and governors here before, but that's been a while. The public simply had a right to know what was going on in this case. I was very glad that a lot of other media, the Associated Press, the Wall Street Journal, West Virginia Public Broadcasting under Scott Finn's leadership, National NPR, where Howard Berkus has done such remarkable work on this disaster, joined our newspaper in fighting that secrecy. We won that case, but only after we appealed to the First Circuit Court in Richmond, and after news organizations from all around the country filed a brief on our behalf. After that, we were able to write a lot of important stories about what was being argued in the case, how the lawyers were trying to shape the case before trial, what evidence would get in and what evidence wouldn't. It's kind of ironic that Blankenship actually opposed the idea of lifting the gag order. Because a key part of our job in covering criminal courts is to make sure that the defendants aren't being railroaded. We don't try people in star chambers in this country. The courts have to be open. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. I also want to say about Judge Berger that she was very impressive during this trial. You talk about a West Virginia success story. Irene Berger is a West Virginia success story. In this case, she faced a lot of fancy lawyers from out of town who wanted to object to everything. A huge part of their strategy was just to object to everything, hoping that eventually when they appeal, one of those objections will stick. And you would think that over the course of 2 months, day after day after day of objection, that at some point the judge would lose her cool a little bit and shut them down. Tell them to go sit down, I don't want to hear it. Which is exactly what the defense lawyers wanted her to do. Never once did Judge Berger do that. Oh, she was patient. And as someone who's often struggled with patience, I really admire that. She showed a lot of restraint, class, and poise. She showed us how to be judicial. Federal courts in and of themselves present a huge problem for the media, especially in the digital age. There are no computers, no cell phones, definitely no cameras. I got stopped at security the other day because I accidentally left the charger for my laptop in my briefcase, and they didn't want me carrying the charger in. So to show people what the trial looked like, we had to hire a sketch artist, Jeff Pearson, a talented guy who had actually taught my son some art classes, and he had never done this sort of work before, and said he would give it a try. Another fellow, Rob Cleland, also drew sketches, and if you have an opportunity, if you go down to Taylor Books in their gallery, they have a show of all of the artwork from the trial, and some of it is really fantastic. While we were sitting there, we couldn't type up and email in periodic updates for our website, let alone live tweet the trial. We actually asked Judge Berger to allow us to live tweet the trial. I picture her just falling out of her chair laughing that we even bothered to ask her. But we wanted to keep people up to date, so we did it the old-fashioned way, calling the updates in, often from a payphone. Sometimes I made up the updates as I talked to an editor. Other times I wrote them out longhand on paper, and Joel Ebert had the just horrible task of trying to make out my writing and typing them up for our Cold Tattoo blog. About that payphone, at first I could use the one on the fifth floor, just outside of Judge Berger's courtroom. But then it turned out that the area where the payphone was an area that security wanted the jury to be able to use for a lounge. It had some nice comfy chairs and a couch. So they blocked that area off. So I had to, whenever I wanted to call in, ride up to the sixth floor and use the payphone there. At one point, the mouthpiece stopped working on that payphone, and I would call. And Greg can tell you, I would call, and he would be saying, "What? What? I can't hear you." You know, it was a cell phone commercial. So I would be standing there whacking it, trying to get it to work, and looking around hoping some security officer didn't walk by and arrest me for damaging government property or something. At one point, Judge Johnston, the phone was right outside of Judge Johnston's chambers, and at one point I was just done using the phone, and Judge Johnston walked out, and he said, what are you doing here? Aren't you downstairs? And I said, well, I'm using the payphone. He said, I didn't know we still had that. I did get into one little bit of the trouble with a security guard. I had been told it was okay to use the stairs to go down to the lobby. Well, apparently it wasn't okay to use the stairs to go down to the lobby. That was determined to be a security breach, and I was briefly questioned by a deputy marshal who wasn't very happy that I'd used the stairs. But those security guys have a pretty difficult job. As you can see from the photo, emotions were very high, and it's their job to keep order, and they did a good job. Judge Berger gave us a lunch break every day, but for us in the media, that was often work time, updating a story, adding something to the website, downloading newly filed documents to take print out to take to the courthouse and read. We made a lot of trips up and down Virginia Street between the courthouse and the newspaper. At that point, the construction was about like it is now, and we had to zigzag three times with all of the sidewalk being blocked off. Often there wasn't much time for lunch. I had set a goal of definitely not eating one of those big Jimmy John subs every day for lunch. My wife and my doctor were both very happy, and I can report now that I lost about 12 pounds during the trial. A word about our website, our Dawn Blankenship landing page. That was all Joel Ebert and our IT staff. I kind of balked at the idea. I wasn't sure it would work, and thought it would be a bust, and then it would end up being a pain to update every day. But Joel came up with several different kinds of timelines and backgrounders and a map and a resource page with exhibits and transcripts, different entry points, he explained to me, for different kinds of readers. One of the many things I learned from him during this trial. About those exhibits, that's something else you can thank Sean McGinley, the newspaper's lawyer, for. Sean filed a motion to have Judge Berger order both sides to every day provide us with the trial exhibits so that we could share them with our readers. Most of them were just documents, were 500 of them. Using a tool called Document Cloud, we were able to post them on our website with a searchable index. And importantly, those exhibits included the audio of Blankenship's phone calls. Were it not for Sean and this motion, the public wouldn't have ever gotten to hear Blankenship's voice. They would have been played in court, but we wouldn't be allowed to record what happens in court. But we got those files, and they're posted online now. Public Broadcasting certainly was interested in being able to play those, and they were very kind enough to join us in bringing that legal action. Joel Liebert, by the way, also played photographer most days. Coming down to take photos of Blankenship and his lawyers coming and going. More importantly, he got photos of almost all of the witnesses as they came or went. So while we didn't have pictures of them testifying, we could show readers at least a headshot or something. My only rule of photography was to tweet an iPhone shot of the courthouse each morning just to remind people that we were back in the trial. Though I did take and tweet one of the first shots of Blankenship when he arrived that day, getting out of that beat-up blue minivan. Part of the legal action we didn't win was an effort to have the jury selection take place in public. It's our right and your right to watch and listen to jury selection. What are the lawyers asking? How are the jurors answering? What are the guidelines? Who's being thrown off of the jury and for what reason? Is no one who ever belonged to a union allowed on the jury? We don't know. If we can't see that process, we can't report that to readers and tell them how it was done. Well, except for one day, early in the jury selection process, when some poor court staffer inadvertently posted the transcript of that day's jury selection on a public computer in the clerk's office. And I stumbled upon that and sat there and scribbled down as much of it as I could before somebody noticed what we were up to and put a stop to it. Maybe someday soon, maybe as part of the appeal, we'll get to see some of that. Maybe Judge Berger will make those transcripts public. Maybe Judge Berger will also make public the transcripts of all the important evidentiary rulings that she made in private bench conferences, which were held with white noise playing in the courtroom so we and the jury couldn't hear what was being argued about. I don't know if the public really understands what big trials like this are like. I don't see how lawyers live like this. It's not over when the jury goes home for the day. It's really just starting. They've got to go prepare for the next day. They've got to prep witnesses and read transcripts. And for us, we would get back to the newsroom at 5:30, which is already past our deadline for that day's paper, and have to try to get as much of it we could in. I try to remind myself every day of what the late Gazette editor Don Marsh used to say about covering the Moore administration and legislative corruption cases in the 1980s, that the paper's job was really to kind of be a stenographer, to squeeze as many of those facts that come out each day into that story as we could. So it made for some late nights and really long stories. One of our assistant city editors, Ashley Craig, who hadn't worked with me before the merger, deserves a big raise for dealing with those stories on many of those nights. I think the only time she really complained about how long a story was when a juror went home sick and I wrote 30 inches about it. I really tortured myself over those stories sometimes, though. And the point I wanted to make here is that journalism isn't really the first rough draft of history. It's more than that. Because the thing that haunts me when I'm writing these stories is that someday some grad student is going to be looking at these Gazette Mail archives to try to understand all of this. My job is to try to explain it to today's readers, but it weighed on me during this trial, having used newspapers to understand previous mining disasters, that one day this was going to be source material for somebody's book or somebody's dissertation. God help them. I should probably start wrapping up, but I want to say one thing that I'm convinced of after this experience is that most of us, myself included, don't understand nearly enough about our court system. Lawyers and judges often aren't much help in understanding the world. Some special interests are intent on us not understanding it, especially if you're talking about the complicated world of civil lawsuits, which are really nothing more than society's way of trying to settle disputes between neighbors without things turning into the Wild West. In criminal courts, though, it seems to me that a lot of people who might not have liked Don Blankenship were willing to throw their otherwise ACLU-like ideals under the bus. Let's just convict the guy. To hell with the rules, right? You're not wrong. The government, the federal government especially, has great power in criminal courts to take our liberty away. And I don't mean liberty like something like, you know, what Obamacare is taking away from you. I mean lock you up, tell you when you can eat, tell you when to sleep, tell you when you can go to the bathroom. Those are incredible powers and they're open to abuse. And people that think that Don Blankenship shouldn't have gotten a fair trial and shouldn't have gotten a good defense, you could be the next one that's on trial. But it's also true that there are different kinds of justice for different players in our society. The rich, by and large, without besmirching the skills of public defenders, can get more justice than the rest of us. Blankenship had great lawyers, and they had an almost unlimited budget. They filed dozens of motions. That doesn't happen in most criminal trials. Heck, most criminal defendants in federal court don't even go to trial. They can't afford it. Our society would be better off if we all understood these things, and if we knew how the courts really worked. I don't know where to start in trying to touch on all the things I learned about criminal courts and covering this case. Did you know that the jury doesn't even see the indictment? I've covered a lot of court cases, and I didn't know that. I learned that during this case. My wife would tell you that I've learned more than she wanted me to learn about the hearsay rule. The hearsay rule is off limits in our house. But my understanding of our world was a lot richer for the patience that people in the U.S. Attorney's Office and Judge Berger in explaining things from the bench, and sometimes even Blankenship's lawyers, who were very good and occasionally somewhat helpful in explaining things. I guess the last thing I'll mention is that if you didn't like something about one of my stories, blame me. I was given great freedom to try to navigate how we should cover this. And I can't thank the paper enough, my editors, its owners, for that. They make me proud of the place where I work. Lots of things about our coverage, though, I shouldn't get any credit for at all. Take this front page over here. That headline screaming, "I hold a tombstone, you hold nothing," above a 6-column photo of one of the UBB family members who shouted down Blankenship outside the courthouse after the hearing. When I first saw the page proof, I usually don't see these, but I was there that late that night, and I wasn't sure about this approach. I mean, I was thinking, where's the picture? Where's the big picture of Blankenship walking out? That's the front page, right? Well, that photo was taken by a guy named Brian Ferguson. Very talented guy. He's got more talent in his index finger than I have in my whole body. And he took that photo. How he did it, I don't know. Pushing him on the crowd, leaning over Blankenship's shoulder, somehow getting in focus. And he took that photo, and he took it to Rob Byers, one of my bosses, who he'd worked for on hundreds of assignments over many years, and said, kind of quietly, I've got something. This should be our lead shot. And a fellow named Philip Maramba designed the page. A guy named Chris Atkins cleaned up all of my typos. He probably needed help from a few other people for that. And you know what? That photo told the story. That was the trial. That's Tommy Davis. He worked at the UBB mine with his son, Corey Davis, his brother, Timmy Davis, and his nephew, Josh Napper. All three of them died in this explosion. Think of it, your nephew. That's bad enough, right? But a nephew, you can get through that. Your brother, that's a lot of grief. Your son, well, that's unspeakable. My son's here today, I can't imagine. But all three of them at once, in one day, dead, gone, just like that. I mean, there just aren't any words. And Steve Ruby reminded us during the Blankenship sentencing hearing with this story, despite all the legal arguments, courtroom tactics and politics, and complicated mind safety tutorials, he reminded us what this case was all about. He reminded us that Blankenship conspired to commit the type of violations that he knew and that everybody in the industry knew risked causing a disaster. Violations of the kind that caused disasters in the past. And to properly weigh the seriousness of that offense and what justice requires here, it is critical to remember that the lives defendant risked were real lives. They weren't abstractions. These people weren't just numbers on one of the reports that the defendant got every 30 minutes. Bill Taylor, the lead defense lawyer, didn't like this. He called them word pictures. He kept saying word pictures that Rudy was using, and said they didn't belong in the courtroom. Ruby said they were flesh and blood human beings with good lives that deserved to be protected. They were husbands and fathers and sons and brothers and uncles. They weren't fungible units of labor. They were men, and in some cases women, who hunted and fished and rode four-wheelers and watched football and basketball games with their families. They had lives that were immensely worthy and immensely important to the people who loved them. That's what was at stake. That's what the defendant, by conspiring to violate the mine safety laws, chose to gamble with, and all just for the sake of the money. Thank you all very much, and I'll try to answer any questions anyone has.